Hi, my name is Dino Olada. I am conducting an oral history interview with Mari Mujica. Today is April 19th, 2017. It's about 11:30 a.m. and we are in Shelbyville, Kentucky. So Mari, the first question that I have for you is, how did you or your family come to be in Louisville?
So we, my husband took a job with the university. And so that's how we got to Kentucky. And we were in Louisville for about 9 years. And then we decided to move to a farm. And here we are in Shelbyville. Before being in Kentucky, we were in Massachusetts for about 15 years. Where he also was working at the university as a professor. And before that, we were in Iowa. That was our first stop in the US. And that was over 30 years ago. There, he was doing a postdoc and I ended up getting into school because that was my best. It was a college town and I didn't have a working visa. Actually, I think, you know, that visa that people are talking about right now, the HB, so that's what he had as an exchange, exchange something. And anyway, so, yeah. So that's how we got here.
Will you tell me more about your story of maybe why you came to United States?
Yeah, well, the synopsis of my story is that we left Peru newly married, and my husband had a scholarship to go to England, and that year was extended. The scholarship was extended. He ended up completing his PhD there, so we stayed 2.5 years. And then after that, in the sciences, it's really recommended that you do a postdoc, and so he had a postdoc in Iowa. And our plan was to go back to Peru. Then I got into school, and so we ended up prolonging that. At one time, the funding for the research he was doing was stopped, and then he was asked to teach, if he wanted to teach, and it was just a temporary. And then on the second year, he was asked to stay. And by then, we had everything lined up to go back to Peru. We already had our first child. And I was finishing the PhD program there in anthropology. And actually, I had written a grant that was going to give us funding for the whole family because my concern was going back to Peru and having to start working right away, I would never finish the PhD, because that happened actually to my brother a number of years before. You know, it's very difficult to just come back. I mean, get the funds to come back. And so what happened was there was a lot of things going on. The situation in Peru was really difficult. And especially in the sciences, there wasn't a lot happening. And even less if you are in the sciences and an academic. And so, the grant that I had was perfect, because for 1 year we were set up. I was going to be able to finish. But then I remember my brothers, one of my brothers wrote to us and sent us like an article that had been published in the paper where the scientific community was just having some complaints with the government. At that time, we had Alan Garcia as a president. And at the bottom of the article, he had written, "Do not come back." And there was that. We had a Peruvian friend living in Chicago at the time who had been looking for work for years, and he couldn't get work. And And then the chair of the department, who was begging my husband to stay teaching for one more year, mm-hmm. and it almost felt like we were going against all odds. And ultimately, I remember I was preparing for my comps, and I was like sitting and writing down pros and cons of staying and going. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty even, but then there were two things that really tipped it towards staying. The first one was that from here we were able to send some money to my in-laws who needed some extra support, and we didn't know if working in Lima or in Peru we could do that. And the second was the thought that if we stayed at any point we could just decide to go back home. But if we went back home and then wanted to come back, that was going to be a lot more difficult. So we decided, okay, if we stay, we can reverse that at any time, but not the opposite. So we decided to stay. And it was a kind of like a temporary decision. But then that's when he applied for tenure track jobs. Mm-hmm. So our story is one of a lot of privilege, because we already left home with a college degree, mm-hmm. and that in itself just opened doors for us in England and opened doors for us here, and so then, you know, that's when he got the job in Massachusetts. I ended up going to Peru with my son and doing the research there, staying with mm-hmm. my mother. And my father had died that year, so we were away. We were apart for months at a time so that I could complete the PhD. But then I also decided not to continue my research, because I felt very strongly that I wanted to do research where I lived, so that I wasn't just researching people, but really collaborating at some level, no, being part of that community. So yeah, that's our story. So then, you know, when the mm-hmm. job opened here, it was a great opportunity for us to move here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did your family feel about leaving? Did they come with you to Peru? Was it just you and your husband, and then you?
We were newly married, so we didn't have. Well, okay. My family. I have a large family in Lima. I have 7 siblings, and they all live there. Uh-huh. Yeah, all in the same city. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these siblings have children that now are having children. Very tight knit family. My children are in a WhatsApp. With all the cousins. And I, you know, we have a WhatsApp of all the brothers and sisters, and then mm-hmm. I have one just with the sisters. We are in, it's great that technology now keeps us in the loop, but at the same time it's like, oh no, they're getting together and we are not there. Or such and such is having a baby and we want to be there.
How did they feel about your decision coming to the United States for your job?
Well, you know, as I said, at the beginning it was temporary. And even for us, it was almost like a big adventure, because the plan was to go back. Mm-hmm. So basically, Tango, come here. Tango, come here. She's not crazy about dogs, okay? So basically, we were on this big adventure, you know, and newly married, so it was a great experience for us to be away from what we had grown up with, mm-hmm. from the family. Then when we started having a family, and I was still a student actually when we had my oldest son, that was very difficult. It was also aggravated by the fact that my father had just died. My father died about 2 weeks before my son was born. So, yeah, that was a very painful time. I still, when I think about it, and we didn't have any family or advice or anything, and then, you know, like the breastfeeding problems, and I mean all of that, but which sometimes people prefer not to have family around because everybody tells you something, especially in our culture. But yeah, it was when I see my nieces having their babies and their, you know, my brothers or sisters or in-laws, sisters or brothers-in-law being there and visiting all the time, I'm like, oh, I didn't have that.
Yeah.
So in a way, it kind of makes a, I think that's, you know, so that's when I think we start becoming immigrants, really. Like, I don't think we saw ourselves as immigrants at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then once we decide to stay, and then once, well, then we, again, we had the privilege of having a path to citizenship because we were working and earning enough to pay a lawyer to start with the paperwork.
Yeah.
But also we had the university saying, yeah, this is a full-time employed, and, you know, they kind of vouch for you, even if they don't do the process, didn't do the process for you at that time. And there were a number of reasons why we wanted to become citizens. By that time, my daughter had already been born too, and she was, it's funny, she was about 2, I think, or 3, and she was so excited because we always told them, this is your country and we have our country and you are also Peruvian, but, you know, this is your flag. And we tried to not create a negative image of, you know, the country that they are growing up. So when we were about to become citizens, my daughter says, oh, Mom, I'm so excited. Now we are all going to be American. I cannot forget that. Like, American. And but for us, well, it meant a lot of things. It meant that my husband could write grants as a citizen, because a lot of grants for funding for doing research in the sciences are only for U.S. citizens.
Yeah.
It meant, we were also very interested in participating in the political process. You know, we're here, what is our contribution? And what was an amazing relief was the sense of, like, we finally didn't have to feel so insecure every time we went to request a visa or every time we flew home, which is also a privilege that, you know, that money-wise, but also status-wise, that you can go and visit your family. But I remember when I went for my brother's wedding, my youngest brother's wedding, we were living in Massachusetts already, and I was still writing my dissertation, and I had a grant from the University of Iowa to that was paying me my TA money without having to teach. So it was in order to be able to write, so I could be anywhere. And when I went to renew the visa, because once you leave the country, then you have to go back to the embassy and request a new visa. While you stay in the country, they just extend it to you while you continue to be a student. He said, but what are you doing in Massachusetts if you're studying in Iowa? I said, well, I have this grant, and I wanted to be with my husband. And the officer was very, like, I was afraid that he would not let us back. Like, he wouldn't get us a visa, and said, oh, you have to regularize your situation or something. And I said to him, what are you suggesting, that we apply for citizenship or for a green card? I don't know what I said. But, and then, I did get the visa. And at that moment, we had already actually started the paperwork. And it was, I mean, like the two different lines that you go through when you arrive at the airport, it was just, it gave us so much peace of mind.
Yeah.
It took it removed a huge stress.
Yeah.
And I mean, can you imagine, you know, and this is within this very privileged scenario, because it's true.
So all of your siblings still back in Lima?
Yeah. Some of them in the same neighborhood where we grew up. Wow. One of my brothers actually bought the house from us, the house where we grew up. It's pretty amazing.
So do you feel any type of disconnect because you have this type of privilege and maybe some of them are still back at home?
In the sense of family and the connection, I don't have the privilege of that connection because I'm not there to share, convivir, to share in their everyday life. So, they are all professionals and they all have established families. And so, I think I become more and more aware of the richness at one level, the richness of the family connection and the family care and how everybody is there for everybody else. Which is different. I mean, you just end up, and I feel so that my family, we are just a nuclear family and very nuclear. So the four of us, and right now actually both of my children are living with us. Temporarily, we know that it's not forever, and I can see that we are big, you know, it's like that's all we have. There's some of the holidays, and that's all we have, each other. We kind of long for the family everyday interaction. But as I said, you know, I mean, we just found out, actually, my daughter found out that one of my nieces is pregnant. Because, you know, it was a WhatsApp to all the cousins. And so I get home and so we said, oh, let's call her. So, you know, we talk with her. And then the next day I call my sister. So that makes it a little, it's so important. I realize the older I get, I have been trying to go visit once a year, because that's the only way I see them. Some of them have come, but it's not that easy to come from there to here. Even though they all have, you know, they have a comfortable life, but and so, you know, and then there is work also, so the more you work, the less time you have. If your work is a little bit more sporadic, the less you can afford to come. So I have just decided, okay, I have to go to see them, and I realized that maybe I need to go more often, which is also a privilege, you know, that I could afford to do that. But to really keep the strong connection, if I skip a year, it's so hard because you haven't been part. It's almost like I go and then when I come back, the phone calling and the texting becomes easier through via WhatsApp, because you have just connected. Like you have a mental map of what are they doing in the morning, what's their routine, and what time is a good time to call, that kind of thing. But when I, you know, the months go by, and then of course there is a change of season also, which is, you know, they are more available as the summer comes here, which makes, you know, like we spend more time outside, etc. So, yeah, that's funny, it's interesting. But yeah, I think the biggest loss for me is that I had to raise my kids without this amazing super committed love of the extended mm-hmm. family. And they didn't have that growing up. And they long for that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, they feel very connected. Yeah. Mm. It seems that it strikes a chord with you, too.
Yeah, yeah, it does. That's definitely a cultural thing for me. And I grew up with an extended family. Mm-hmm. But then moving around, I kind of lost that, so.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering, so, like, whenever you were in Peru, like, can you talk more about your family life there, like, growing up with your extended family, and maybe, like, some of the figures that you looked up to who raised you?
Well, you know, my grandmother on my father's side, because mm-hmm. his father had died when I think right before my parents got married, and my grandfather on my mother's side, mm-hmm. who actually had my mother's mom died when she was like 15, so but that whole family, so she and her four brothers moved in, and my grandfather moved in to live with my grandfather's sisters, right. And I met two of them. There was a third, and they were all maiden single women,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, older. They were like great aunts to us, but it was like, it seemed like the family life,
yeah.
was, they were the centerpiece, and my grandmother, and they both, like, my grandfather lived right around the corner from us, mm-hmm. so I remember, like, having certain toys that stayed at their house, because
yeah.
we would just take off and go. And then we had this aunt, the Tia Maria, who was the one that survived my grandfather and the sisters, and in fact, when my grandfather died, the house where we grew up is full of additions, because with eight siblings, and then
yeah.
so we kind of added or kind of put a roof over an area that had been more open
mm-hmm.
when my grandfather died, so that my aunt Tia Maria could move in with us. But so some she prepared desserts, sugar like crazy. We had sugar like crazy, and like she would prepare jello for mm-hmm. my grandfather, and she will add sugar, so we loved her
Sounds
jello. And we would go and say, "Tia, I'm hungry. Tengo hambre." And she would say, "Oh, would you like some crackers?" She always had like the Maria crackers,
uh-huh.
or, no, those sweet. And or she also had like hard candy. Mm-hmm. I can show you. I bought, every time I go to Peru, I buy some. We call them peritas. They have the shape of a little pear.
Mm.
They're, anyways, red and yellow. And she would say, "Oh, would you like some crackers?" "No, I'm hungry for jello," we would say, and because we saw the jello and we knew that it was always sweeter than at home. But so we had a lot of that. We spent a lot of time with them, and we would just walk from their house to our mm-hmm. house. And then the grandma, so, and every Sunday there was we call it lonche,
mm-hmm.
which is like a tea, like mm-hmm. tea time, you know, 5 o'clock, and the cousins will come. But it was every Sunday. I mean, it was just every Sunday. And all the, you know, I mean, a lot of sweets and chicha morada, which is like this really nice purple drink, which is made out of blue corn, and really like traditional Peruvian. And so when my grandfather passed away, and we moved my aunt with us, the lunches were at my house, at our house. And the same, you know, cousins, but also like extended family, you know, mm-hmm. like some were like a really good friend of my mom, she was almost like her sister,
mm-hmm.
and then her daughter, and then also some of the cousins who, you know, then they got married and their children. So it just kept, and people just knew that they could come. They will call sometimes, but they... I always wanted to kind of recreate that tradition,
yeah.
and I never was able to do it. It just like didn't work out with the kinds of lives that we live here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, but I always, I mean, at one point, I always wanted to do that. And for it to be open, it's not only family, but that friends would know that. Yeah, I don't know. It's just like you work so much during the week, and then in the weekend you don't want to do anything because you're so tired. And so that's one of the three. And then with my grandmother on my father's side, she would come, Bentango, come here. That's what he wants. Oh.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. So on my grandmother, she would come for lunch every Sunday. No, every Saturday. And some of the memories I have, and she would bring marshmallows, but the marshmallows were not like the ones you find now, but they were harder, and they had all of these different, like, pastel colors, and they had like these designs as a, of shells, of different shells. It's like, I've never seen them again. Are you okay? Are you sure? And so she will bring that for after lunch. And but what if I got a book or a story, we would give it to her. She will learn it and then she will tell us the story. Oh. So we will see it like on. I mean, it was just amazing. Mm-hmm. And then on Sundays, sometimes we will pick her up and go to church to mass with her. And then on the way back, and this was early, like 8 o'clock probably in the morning. And then on the way back, we will stop by this store and buy cream crackers, they were called. Mm-hmm. They are like...
The cream is inside? Or
there's no cream in them, but it's they are like soda crackers, but they are thicker and a lot... I think they have some kind of fat in them, so they were bigger, they were like this size, and cheese, so we will and once in a while like ham, but cheese and ham were like totally special occasion. Mm-hmm. It's we never had that in the house. I guess that if we got it, somebody will eat them before the time they were going to use also, but you know, because we never lacked anything. I mean, we went to really private schools, like more like religious schools, like parochial or, you know, we always had the uniform. And I remember that the policy was to buy like really good shoes that will last you through the year. So we grew up with a lot more than many people, even in our neighborhood or in Peru for sure. But at the same time, there wasn't excess. I remember talking with my mom at one point about how, like, we got one present at Christmas time, one present in our birthday. And then, you know, going out for ice cream was like a once in a very blue moon or... I mean, I remember going to a movie, the whole family, maybe twice when I was growing up. Things like that. Very kind of measured and no waste at all. And I once asked my mom, like, you know, why, what was our, like, did we have enough or did we didn't have enough? And she said, you know, I think we had more than we needed, but to me it was very important to raise you in a way that you didn't have more than you needed, because I didn't think that was right. So there are a few things like that from my mom. I mean, there's, you have a question about who has influenced you. And I think my mom has influenced me a lot, like her values and her... She always did some volunteer work in areas that other people wouldn't dare to go to. Because Lima is surrounded by a belt of very low income. I mean, poor people, what you would say. I hate to use the word poor because I think... there is a lack of economic resources. But and you know, things like every year we will share one of our favorite toys, actually, mm-hmm. with a group of kids that I will never. I have this image engraved in my mind of the doll that my grandmother had made for me. It was and I loved that doll, and so I gave it away that Christmas, and I remember so the girl that got it started like to twirl with the doll, you know, like how and it's like engraved in my mind. One of my sisters feels that that was not a good, like it was too much for us as children to be expected to give up our favorite toy. So it's interesting because I never thought of that as a, you know, growing up with privilege. It was just like you grow up, it's your culture, it's your, you never think about that. We were very aware that there were a lot of people that had a lot less than us, including, I mean, in Peru, it's very common to have people working in your house. You either, maybe at this time it's a little different, but when I was growing up, you either could afford to have someone working at your house or you had to work in someone's house. That was kind of like the divide. And there are horrible stories, I mean, of abuse and all kinds of abuse. And there's some interesting Latin American and Peruvian novels actually that describe that. It was not our experience in my family. I mean, you know, clearly someone that lives and works at your house is in a very vulnerable situation, but we would get in really big trouble if we demanded anything or were disrespectful, or even like if in some, you would go to somebody's house and they will say, I will ask, you know, whoever was working there to go to the store and get to the bodega, we call it like the corner store, to get me some soda or something. We were absolutely not allowed to ask anything like that. You know, they had their jobs. There was the time when we were not to disturb them because it was their rest time.
Yeah.
But, and I think that was really good. But still, you know, I think living and see, and so not living in that situation has made me a lot more aware of how, of the extent of the privilege and of the vulnerability. In fact, I wrote my master thesis on that.
Oh, wow.
And I cried like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that? I'm very curious.
Gosh, all of this is on tape. I cannot believe it. So when I was in England, I got into a master's program.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to do my research on, you know, all the issues of gender and class and race in the institution of domestic service. And it was great because I was away, so it was an opportunity to be, but it was painful. It was painful. I mean, things that were the most painful, I guess, one of them is, well, you know, we had mamas, which is like a nanny.
Yeah,
but it's a different status than the nanny here in this country. And we call them mama, right? So in our case, we had, like, every two of us had a mama, and when we were little. And so, you know, so my mama is still alive, and she has a family and grandchildren and everything. And I visit her once in a while. But then she got married when I was, like, about maybe four or five. So my brothers, so the two brothers before me, mm-hmm. their mama became the mama of the four of us. So we call them mama. And now it's like mommy is the mother and mama. And I mean, she was tough with me sometimes, but Aquila. But I remember a lot of, I mean, I remember her room. I remember she loved this singer, Pedrito Rico. But so then Aquila got married also when she was, well, by that time we didn't need a mama. I mean, you know, but she was working at home mm-hmm. until she got married. And I have a picture actually of us in her wedding, some of us in her wedding. Yeah, I can show you. And but then, so she had one child, one girl, and then she had twins. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, apparently, she realized she was pregnant because they had screened her, and they found some cancer or something like that. So. She delivered, had the babies, everything, but I don't remember exactly when, but then she ended up getting really sick and dying and very poor. And one of the things I was grappling with when I was writing and was the how sad, no, that this woman was actually did some art around that as well. That she took care of us when we were young, and yet mm-hmm. she died in such poverty. So the family is still connected to my family. You know, there are ways in which some members of my family, so you know, try to support these mm-hmm. kids that are now grown up and the dad. But there is a disconnect there. Yeah. No, it's like, and then of course, one of the things I write about is like, many people say, oh, it's like a member of the family.
Yeah.
But really, they're not.
Yeah.
So, and I do believe that there are relationship, you know, affection relationships. Mm-hmm. But still, there is this class divide, which is huge. And it's seldom, I think, that gets bridged. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the thoughts that made me cry a lot. Or when we were just married, there was this man who had worked for my grandfather, mm-hmm. Camilo. He was amazing, and we also built a room for him mm-hmm. when my aunt moved in with us. And he would just take care of the things that belong to the Tia Maria. We used to joke because, like, you know, you will get something out to cook something. And when you came back, you went to the fridge to get there was like a few steps between the area where we prepare the food. And you went to the fridge to get the eggs and you went back and that had been put away because Camilo will put it away. And then he will buy the paper and bread in the morning. That was his job, really. And I mean, basically. But then, you know, then he got sick, and then he chose, I think, to go live with a brother or a sister or something. But I remember when Camilo died, and I was newly married, and I was living kind of like in Shelbyville, as opposed to Louisville, away. And when he had been ill, so you know, I was checking with my mom, like, how is Camilo doing? Mm-hmm. and then Camilo died. Mm. And so I asked, you know, where was he going to be, I mean, not buried, but the wake, where was he going to be, and all of that. And this is, you know, that's one of the contradictions, no? And my mom, I remember my mom saying on the phone, you don't have to come. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, and I don't even remember if I ended up going or not, but just the thought that my mom is very loving and it's an amazing woman, and mm-hmm. but just, you know, that I don't know if she would have said the same if it was a family member, now that I think back. And she may have, if it wasn't like a brother, right? Thank God they're all alive. But anyways, I went on to a...
Did you end up going?
I don't remember. I don't remember if I ended up going or not. I just remember how that... coming from my mom took me back. And now I'm thinking maybe she would have been the same. You know, she was the kind of person that would be, I mean, she was pretty liberal in her in how she brought us up in many ways, so that, you know, it's like, oh no, you have to be there. It was the opposite. It was, you know, letting us be wherever we were more. But at that point, it felt like, how can you say that? If it was Camilo, no? So I would never know.
Wow. Can you tell me more about your mom and what values that you feel like you've taken from her while growing up?
Well, I think family, amazing commitment to family. There's no question, but I think that that's around the whole family. But she was always, and I don't think it's a coincidence that as siblings we are so close to each other, because she would always say, you know, and actually I do the same with my kids. I say, you know, someday it would be just you and you, the two of you. So, but what else? Really an amazing positive attitude to being open-minded for her times, very, very open-minded for her times, and curious, you know, interested in learning. But I think the one of the most valuable things that I learned from her, and I would really, like, I aspire to be like her, is her being non-judgmental. And, you know, it's really funny because, like, we had this cousin whose wife is lovely and everything, loving. But she was, like, you know, we would say pesada, you know the word pesada, like...
Like it weighs?
It's not that she waits, it's that it's like, oh, you know, she's always, like, getting... She was a lot older than us, but she will be... Ask us, you know, if we had a boyfriend or, and did your mom let you... I mean, she was just, like, the entrometida, you know, like, we just... what's the word in English? I don't know.
I know it because my friends call me it, but I...
Yeah?
I can't think of it right now. I don't know.
Yeah.
It'll come to me.
Anyways, so, you know, we would say, oh, Claudia, da da da. And, or she will, you know, she will tell us off for things, like if we were doing something that she didn't think. She was, and she was very proper and, you know, very Catholic and, you know, so... She was really trying to impose those values on us, and I don't know. And I remember we would complain to my mom and say, "Ah, oh, Gloria, que pesada," and she would say, "But she's a really good woman. I mean, you know, and she's really, look how she visits your grandmother always." And so she will always find something positive about someone that... I had her come all the way. So my mother will always find, like, something positive to say. Like, you would complain about some person, and she will... the thing is, she never... You never heard something out of her mouth. You never heard... something negative about her talking about something negative about somebody else. And I think that that's an amazing quality, because it's so easy to criticize people or find fault in others. So I think, to me, that's a huge... I do feel that I communicate with her all the time.
Can you tell me about your dad?
So my dad was also one of eight. And he was, they say he was old since he was young. He was always, you know, like he was big and slow. And he went to school actually when we were already born because he had to go and start working when his father died to help. I don't know if they had some land or something, but he had to go and take care of some things that his father had done before. And so he became a lawyer and then a notary. And a notary in Peru is very different than a notary here. There's only a few, like you have to apply to become a notary, and only a few people, depending on the population of the town that you live. There are only a certain number of notaries. And any commercial transaction is done in front of a notary. So, you know, like if you sell a house, if you buy a house, if you are leaving something for your, like a, how this called?
A will
is done in front of a notary, all of that. And so, and he was very, very well respected. And very, they were, you know, even though they were both very Catholic, and even though they were very Catholic, well, of course, they raised us Catholic, or they thought they were raising us Catholic.
Yeah.
I really don't consider myself Catholic anymore, although most of my siblings, I think, do. But so I was very critical of the whole being very Catholic or very religious and then being not nice people, right? And I felt that I couldn't accuse my parents of that. They really lived what they preached. So anyways, so his office was in downtown Lima, and he will spend, actually, he was present, but he wasn't present. He wasn't involved with us as my mother was. He will take us on a Saturday for a walk, maybe. That's what I remember. And I think part of it is that I'm one of the youngest also. So when I was born, my father was already 50, and he was always an old man in his demeanor. So I think that's what I remember most. And he had not a temper, but he was like, he will scream for if you left the door open because there was a breeze, and then a minute later he had forgotten about it. I mean, it wasn't, but it was like, oh my God, why do you scream at me like this, you know? So I had an issue with that. But other than that, I mean, he was very, as I said, very, very, very well loved in the community. The outpour of the community, also when my mother died, was amazing. And for example, he would work, I mean, he would leave the house in the morning. He never drove a car.
Really?
So he would take public transportation.
Okay.
And then once in a while, my mother will go and pick him up, and sometimes I will go with her. And he was so, he was never on time. He would make her wait for hours, and I used to get so upset. I said, "How can you stand it?" And she said, "Well, you know, as you get older, you become more patient." And she always had her knitting with her. So, he will come back late sometimes, like 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, and many times, and we would wait for him to get home for us to all have dinner together.
Wow.
And I remember, like, I was just, like, falling. As I wanted to go to bed. And and we had to wait for my dad to get home to eat. But then, so that busy schedule, and then on Saturdays, sometimes I think he went for half a day. Mm-hmm. And then on Saturday or Sunday or evenings or early mornings, people from the neighborhood community, the community near us, would come with paperwork and stuff, and he will always serve them. And like, will never say, oh, why do you disturb me on a Sunday? Or and I remember these nuns will come and say, oh, and they call him Doctorcito, which, you know, he wasn't, but anyways, and I said, oh, Doctorcito, how much do I owe you? And he will say, you just pray for my family. Like, you know, that was the fee. The fee was to pray for his family. And I have a good memory of that. I mean, how... he used to smoke a pipe. And I still, when I smell that smell, I can follow a person with that smell. Yeah. Yeah. My son looks a lot like him. He's a lot like him. It's very interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah. Are there any values that you feel like you carry from your dad?
Well, he used to say a lot, which is also like could be a very controversial phrase, I think. You know, if you look at what privilege means, and he used to say, we have because we give. So, you know, on the one hand is this attitude and this life conviction that you have to share what you have. On the other hand, it's just, to me, it also, it just... justifies the inequities, right? I don't know, at some level I find that phrase problematic, but at another level I feel that was his, that it's a good value, the value of sharing, of that we share as much as we can. And for example, you know, my father had to do with this, not only my mother, but they created they insured the women who worked at the house before there was ever a law about it. And so, and then they would, you know, we had this amazing woman. I also have a picture of her, a Señora Angelica, who used to cook. And at one point, you know, she was getting older and she had grandchildren and stuff. And so they retire her, but with a retirement. So, like, they will keep on paying her salary because she had worked for us all her life. So I think those little things are... to me, they're good values. They're like doing something because it's the right thing to do. So in a way, using your privilege.
Yeah.
In a way, in that way. And I think that's a huge for me. There was something else I was thinking of, and I just forgot. Oh, yeah, he's, how he instilled the respect for my mother. Like, we were not to ever contradict her or say something against her. I mean, it was the worst thing. He would not tolerate that. At the same time, he was very open. Somebody pointed out once, I mean, we had this incredible political discussions at the table because he was more conservative, but it was totally democratic. It was, you know, everybody was, and so since a very young age I engaged in these conversations where we disagreed, and you know, it was, But I think that's really what, so it was, you know, and we are all totally different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like a whole spectrum of the eight of us. And so there was like a respect for who you are and what your ideas are and that kind of stuff. That although he seemed authoritarian mm-hmm. at some level to us, he was not. And then the question, so we will always ask permission for anything to my mom. I mean, my dad wasn't in the equation. So, you know, there was an agreement that she really was the one with the authority in the house for everything. And, you know, any permission. But if my mom asked us, ask your dad, we knew it was a no. Because so my mom asked us, said, well, ask your dad. And so dad would say, did you ask your mom? We knew that was a no. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But otherwise, that, yeah.
That's funny. My parents do that, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Are they in Atlanta?
They're here. Yeah. In Louisville.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We moved here because of Ford.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I'm glad you did.
Can you tell me more about your education growing up? And what you studied and where you went for college?
So my education, so I finished high school and applied right away to college. So it mm-hmm. was like unexpected and a non-brainer. I didn't know, well, I wanted to go into psychology actually. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I mean, it's interesting to look at your life and your education and what you did when you're 60. To look back and you say, well, why didn't they give me some, I don't know, brushes and paint? It's one mm-hmm. that I always say, because it's only in my late years that I identify as an artist, and I'm not a painter at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to draw even, but you know, there are many other forms of art, and I'm a photographer for sure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was encouraged to pursue what I wanted, but then I didn't take the studies very seriously, I think. So mm-hmm. you, in Peru, you have to prepare and take an exam to enter into a university. Mm-hmm. And so I took the exam. Well, so you prepare during the summer and you mm-hmm. take classes, and then you're supposed to study in the afternoon. And it's like really like boring kind of studying. Yeah. And the test is one of those... it's like the ACT, I mean, ridiculous questions that are so confusing. And they train you in this school that you go to prepare, they train you not to respond to the questions that are confusing. Oh. Well, I was nervous. My mom gave me a little, I don't know, Xanax or something like that. Mm-hmm. I answered all the questions. So those are points against you, right? I relaxed too much. Should have known not to take anything. But anyway, so I didn't get into that school. And then between my sister and my mom, managed to pull my documents out of that school so that I could present, you say, like apply to the to another school. And the exam was like 2 months later or something. Mm. And I was kind of devastated. I think that's why they did that. Because I had been saying all the time, oh, if I don't get in, then I will work for my father and then I'll travel. Mm-hmm. Which wouldn't have been a bad thing, I think. But so I ended up getting into a university where... I ended up choosing as a major communication studies. Mm-hmm. And I ended up, that's where I learned photography, although I had just like very basic classes. But I fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up working in film, which was very precarious at the time. like you would work, and it was a privilege just that you worked, yeah. that you got the job, you didn't get paid, because so I did that for a little bit, and then I think after I met GB, actually I realized that either I had a life or I continue with movies, so I decided to have a life, and so that was it was expected that we went to college. And there wasn't a lot of pressure. There wasn't really, I don't know, a culture of studying too much. I mean, you were supposed to study, you were supposed to get good grades, but you would not think about missing a family yeah. occasion because you had to study. I mean, it was unheard of. Mm-hmm. Which was an interesting thing for me when I went to grad school. Mm-hmm. And I think I still prioritize family yeah. over work or anything. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So then I ended up getting more education when I left Peru. Mm-hmm. Because I had the same. I did a master's. I was at this place where there is this amazing Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies in Birmingham, England. And I started, I met somebody that was studying there, a woman from Canada. We were all so young. And I was so puzzled and intrigued by the culture, the punk culture,
yeah.
that I started to go to their library and read about this and just enjoy the research, just finding out, you know, all this. There were different groups in England. It was really strong. This was in the early 80s. And one day we were about to take the bus, I remember, and he said, and I was telling my husband about it, and he says, "Why don't you do a master's?" And I said, "Yeah, why don't I do a master's?" So then I decided to apply, and the place, people come from all over the world just to apply to this place. It's like really well known. And the application process includes an interview where the students and faculty and I think even members of the community interview you. So it's really rigorous. So one of the things I started doing was speaking only English because my English wasn't that good. So I would speak English with him. And then I had a friend from Chile and a friend from Colombia. We agreed that we would only speak English. Actually, the friend from Colombia didn't want to do it, but Pauline and I learned a lot by just practicing. So then I was interviewed. I was super nervous. It was interesting. And this is the most amazing thing. So I got their letter of acceptance, and I have this picture of myself sitting on the steps of the house. We lived in an old Victorian house on the top that the landlords lived in the house. And I opened the letter and they had accepted me. And I thought, then they are not as good as they said. Can you imagine? And then I realized, oh my goodness, what a image of myself to think that, you know, because they accepted me, they're probably not that good. So, but that was a very challenging experience. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting. A lot of new left literature, and it's kind of like American studies, cultural studies. And of course, but it was great for my consciousness because then I realized, well, I think that's the first time I saw myself as a woman of color. Mm-hmm. Like I realized, and it started when a friend of Pakistani origin, who I've lost touch with, but asked me if I wanted to come to her women of color group. And I thought, so I am a woman of color. Like it was the first time. And I think it has to do with the privilege, growing up with the, I think, privilege in our countries. I don't know if it happens the same in
Philippines.
In the Philippines, yeah. But people just see themselves as white.
Yeah.
And but then it also became very evident, very obvious that there was this male dominant, white dominant culture at this place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at the beginning, I came in with this notion that, well, you know, feminism, once you start incorporating feminist ideas, you are really including everyone. And then I saw that, no, that wasn't mm-hmm. true. Or even Marxism, right? So it was, but it was very rigorous, very academic. And well, that's when I wrote my thesis on mm-hmm. domestic service. And that was a great experience, a growing experience. But I learned a lot. And that, I think, prepared me for going into the doctoral program, mm-hmm. which I wasn't that interested again. I mean, I had the opportunity, really. And I had been taking classes from anthropology because it felt like it was the most open. It was the least oppressive of the mm-hmm. disciplines that I had been looking at. Because I felt that it raised the voice of the people. Then I was really disappointed with anthropology because it has a very colonialist mm-hmm. heritage. And it's there. I had actually issues with my faculty because we were doing a lot of gender studies, and I will start questioning if this really applied, for example, to Latinas or to women in Peru.